a better world is to come and tell you why. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. There's a better world is to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We have a little technical difficulty that we had to experience. Hey, that's what makes it live radio, you know. Let me continue. We're going to announce that tonight's show, we've got progressive journalists. We've got Carl Gibson, Steve Horn, Luis Cuevas, Jerry Waxman, and Alan Mackey. Each one an incredibly credentialed progressive journalist and thinker. People you need to hear from, and let's go ahead and do some news. Chelsea Manning has received the Sam Adams Award. It is the acknowledgement for him revealing to some of the world the atrocities of the Iraq War, including the collateral murder video, footage taken in July 2007. The video footage, along with some 500,000 Army documents, are now known as the Iraq War Logs, and the Afghan war logs turned over to WikiLeaks in early 2010. Former NSA execs and SAA-2 awardee emeritus Thomas Drake commented that Manning exposed the dark side shadows of our national security regime and foreign policy follies. Drake writes that Manning's acts of civil disobedience strike at the very core of the critical issues surrounding our national security, public and foreign policy, openness and transparency, as well as unprecedented and relentless campaign by the administration to snuff out and silence truth tellers. And with that, let's have a brief word from our president on his recent comments on the NSA. He said, for example,
an avalanche of unauthorized disclosures would spark controversies at home and abroad that have continued to this day.
Okay. There we go. Now, another story we want to get to is that there are quite a few wonderful events coming up. Next Saturday in Deerfield Beach, the Deerfield Progressive Forum is hosting whistleblower Ray McGovern from the CIA. There's a clean water event in Fort Myers on the 1st of February, and the Progressive Caucus is hosting a Legend Camp this year. It's in Gainesville on the 8th, so get in touch with the Progressive Democratic Caucus of Florida, and you can get more information on that. Okay, next up, Kevin Gustanzola on Obama's NSA homily. And let's remember, of course, that our friends and neighbors in the NSA, it's neighbors spying on us, friends, so don't you worry your cute little head about it. The president delivered a speech on the changes his administration would support on national security agencies, and he focused on what had been done. It seemed like he was lecturing Americans who've been outraged by one news release after another. And there's another interesting comment that our president made. He said,
"And given the fact of an open investigation, I'm not going to dwell on Mr. Snowden's actions or his motivations. I will say that our nation's defense depends in part on the fidelity of those entrusted with our nation's secrets. If any individual who objects to government policy can take it into their own hands to publicly disclose classified information, then we will not be able to keep our people safe or conduct foreign policy. Moreover, the sensational way in which these disclosures have come out has often shed more heat than light. while revealing methods to our adversaries that could impact our operations in ways that we may not fully understand for years to come.
And yet, you know, that contrasts with a statement that we heard quoted on the Colbert Show the other night. It goes something like this.
A new analysis of 225 individuals linked to Al-Qaeda and charged with terrorism since September 11th says NSA bulk surveillance programs, quote, had no discernible impact on preventing acts of terrorism.
See? I don't understand what people like Edward Snowden are so mad about. Is violating everyone's privacy really that bad if it doesn't even work?
Another thoughtful comment by Mr. Colbert. On another front, bloggers may have First Amendment protections. Grant Pass, Oregon, a federal appeals judge ruled Friday that bloggers and the public have the same First Amendment protection as journalists when sued for defamation. If the issue is of public concern, plaintiffs have to prove negligence to win damages. Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ordered a new trial in a defamation lawsuit brought by an Oregon bankruptcy trustee against a Montana blogger who wrote online the court-appointed trustee criminally mishandled a bankruptcy case. Another story I know you'll find hard to believe is that there's a new high in the radiation leakage levels in Fukushima. But that's okay. Don't let that trouble you, because they will be expanding the plant, they've assured us. Okay, and the TPP, you know, those of us who've been following the Trans-Pacific Partnership know that they've been waiting to just the right moment to put that run in to make it a fast track so that we can't have a debate, we can't have public input, we can't be talking about it. They want to hurry up and fast track it, and right now there's just not that support there. So make sure you contact your congressmen and senators and let them know you do not support the fast tracking, which will gut U.S. environmental laws, labor laws, and give us, as they call it, NAFTA on steroids. And of course, are there any jobs left to offshore? Well, maybe a few. Okay. The leaked secret draft of the TPP environmental chapter published by WikiLeaks underscores how multinational corporate interests rule the negotiating process of this important 12-nation treaty, representing more than 40% of the world's GDP and one-third of the world trade. On 13 November last year, WikiLeaks released a secret draft text of the intellectual property rights chapter showing how nations are forced to change laws and prosecute in defense of the biggest corporate interest in the field of intellectual property rights. In sharp contrast, the environmental chapter does not include enforcement mechanisms serving the defense of the environment. It is vague and weak. It adheres to the lowest common denominator of environmental interest. The word appropriate is found in various forms in 43 places in the draft text, in such contexts as where possible and appropriate, parties shall seek to complement and utilize their existing cooperation mechanisms and take into account relevant work of regional and international organizations. The word may is found 43 times in the 23-page draft. Okay, next story. Supreme Court sides with the notorious patent bully Monsanto. Monsanto's reign of intimidation is allowed to continue in rural America, said Food Democracy Now!'s Dave Murphy. U.S. Supreme Court on Monday denied a group of farmers the right to challenge Monsanto's seed patents, and a decision critics charge allows the biotech giant's reign of intimidation to continue. And don't forget, all of these stories are fleshed out with a full article and links if you go to averyvoice.com. That's A-V-E-R-Y, averyvoice, V-O-I-C-E.com. Averyvoice.com, you can see the whole news text. So make sure you check it out and check out the links. Hey, Google, whatever happened to Don't Be Evil? Post Citizens United corporate donors are still shy enough that they shield themselves behind undisclosed corporate donations to nonprofits rather than direct candidate contributions. Now, the Center for Public Integrity has released a detailed report of top corporations and their donors' donations to these nonprofits. They were able to identify direct contributions of at least $185 million. Google, they gleaned information from financial statements and their public records to the extent they were available. Some companies choose to make full disclosure while others disclose nothing, and still others only disclose the name of the organization without the amount given. Google falls into the last category, where we do know who they donated to but not how much. The list is damning. Not only did Google drop contributions into lots of political nonprofits on the right and the left, they align completely with the Koch side of the right-wing nonprofits. For example, they were the only company to disclose donations to Heritage Action, the Jim DeMint Shut Down the Government, Kill Obamacare group, also on their list, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, ALEC American Action Forum, the Federalist Society, Washington Legal Foundation, Competitive Enterprise Institution, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform, Constitution Project, American Conservative Union, CPAC, American Enterprise Institution, Cato Institution, Mercatus Center, the Koch-sponsored economic think tank at George Mason University, and the National Taxpayers Union. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Freedom Industry. Hey, what's under that shell corporation? Why, Charleston, West Virginia, Freedom Freedom Industries. Can't get over that name. The company that fouled thousands of West Virginia's water with a chemical leak into the Elk River filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy Friday. Freedom owes $3.6 million to its top 20 unsecured creditors, according to bankruptcy documents. The company also owes more than $2.4 million in unpaid taxes to the IRS, and the IRS has placed at least three liens on Freedom's property demanding payment. So now they get the corporate polluted property. How's that? Oh, that's right. That's for you. The unpaid taxes date back to at least 2000, according to a lien filed in 2010. Under the bankruptcy code, Chapter 11 permits a company to reorganize and continue operating so they can keep polluting. Hey, is that something? Filing also put on hold all the lawsuits filed against Freedom Industries since the leak last week. About a mile and a half upriver from West Virginia American's plant in Charleston, about 25 lawsuits have been filed against Freedom in Kanawha Circuit Court. The company also faces a federal lawsuit. The company's assets and liabilities are each listed between $1 million and $10 million in bankruptcy filing. Chemstream Holding, Inc. is the sole owner of Freedom Industries, according to the filing. Gary Southern, who's identified as Freedom President, signed all the bankruptcy documents. On Thursday, a source close to Freedom Industries, who asked to remain anonymous because of pending lawsuits, told the Charleston Gazette that Chemstream Holdings is owned by J. Clifford Forrest of Gattanning, Pennsylvania. Forrest is listed as the manager of Freedom affiliates Etowah Tower, Etowah River Terminal, and the POCA Blending in a merger filing from December 31st. Hey, about an hour after its bankruptcy, Freedom filed an emergency motion for what's called a debtor in possession, or a DIP finance, which would allow it to secure up to $5 million loan to continue to function in some capacity. The loan would, according to the filing, provide additional liquidity to Freedom in order to allow it to continue as a going concern. The lender in the debtor in possession case generally gets first priority when it comes for the debtor, in this case Freedom, to pay money back. Under the bankruptcy code, when there's a DIP financing from a DIP vendor, 99% of the time, they get priority over all other creditors, said Bob Simon, a prominent bankruptcy lawyer with the Pittsburgh firm of Reed Smith. You're putting your money at risk, and the debtor is not going to have a lot of options, so your bankruptcy clerk permits the DIP lender to get priority over all other lenders. Freedom has proposed lenders, a company called WV Funding, LLC. That company does not exist in West Virginia, according to business records on file in West Virginia. Pennsylvania Secretary of State also said it has no records for it. The DIP agreement has places to sign for Freedom Industries and for WF Funding by Mountaineer Funding, LLC. Mountaineer Funding was incorporated with West Virginia on Friday. Ooh, looky there. And its one listed member is J. Clifford Forrest, Freedom Industries owner. So they're going to sell it back to themselves and protect themselves from bankruptcy. Isn't that special? But listen, we've got other special news for you from Freedom Industries. You know, they've been providing the poor poisoned people with supposedly safer water. Well, people have begun to complain that the water they're providing, guess what, has the same chemical smell as the water they're getting from their tap. Maybe they're just not getting the kind of water they need. Who would be surprised there? Guess what? Fuchs new high. Tokyo Electric Power measured the amount of beta-emitting radioactivity in more than 2.7 million becquerels per liter. And these measurements were taken on Thursday. There's been a spike of radiation in this area since the beginning of the year. The measurements taken on Monday show 2.4 million becquerels per liter, while the results taken on January indicate the amount of beta at 2.7 million becquerels per liter. Hey, isn't that great? It just goes higher and higher and higher. It's a new high. And, of course, everybody will remember the secret two-way radio spy net now installed by the NSA and computers across the world. The NSA has divided a radio pathway into computers to conduct surveillance. Now, see, in the past, you might have said, well, I'm not worried because I don't connect to the Internet with this computer. Well, guess what? They've got a workaround. They've got a new secret radio connection. Whether or not you're connected to the Internet, you can have it too. So the NASA's devised this. The NSA implanted software in nearly 100,000 computers across the world that allow the U.S. to conduct surveillance on those machines. It can also create a digital highway for launching cyber attacks. While most of the software is inserted by gaining access to computer networks, the NSA has increasingly made use of a secret technology that enables it to enter and alter data in computers, even if they're not connected to the web. How cool is that, huh? So according to the NSA documents, computer experts, and the American officials, the technology which the agency has used since 2008 relies on a covert channel of radio waves that can be transmitted from a tiny circuit board and USB cards inserted surreptitiously into the computers. Cool, cool, cool. And the president has proposed a new kind of limitation. It's an expansion. The Obama proposed changes will allow the NSA to continue or expand vast collection of personal data. 17 January 2014, President Obama said in his first major speech on electric surveillance that the U.S. is not spying on ordinary people who don't threaten our national security, or are they? Obama placed restrictions on access to domestic phone records collected by the National Security Agency, but the changes he announced will allow it to continue or expand the collection of personal data from billions and billions of people around the world, Americans and foreign citizens alike. Ladies and gentlemen, I've got our first guest. Let me welcome Mr. Carl Gibson. Carl, welcome.
Rick, Steve Horn here.
Wow, we have got some really interesting noise tonight. Welcome, sir. How are you?
Rick, this is Steve Horn. I came out for Carl during his slot because I'm taking off from a plane in about 10 minutes.
No problem, Steve. So. What's the good news?
Yeah, well, what I've been working on since 2014 started is basically tracking these freight rail cars carrying oil obtained from fracking in North Dakota. And probably a lot of listeners will know that there was a huge explosion right before the new year on December 30th. Over 400,000 gallons of oil spilled from that explosion in Castleton, North Dakota. Luckily, that explosion didn't kill anyone because that one of those explosions did kill people in Quebec in the summer 2013. But this one was about half a mile from downtown, and as a result, no one died, but the ecosystem around there is probably now ravaged, and we have a kind of a crisis on our hands with these oil trains carrying the substance around the country, really, and around North America, Canada included. So that's a big discussion right now in Congress. There's been letters sent by both the Senate and the House members, such as Peter DeFazio and other, a couple senators sent a letter. The Department of Transportation basically has admitted that what they're carrying on this rail cars is more volatile than they had ever admitted before. So these are chemicals that can explode much more easily than other chemicals. So although they've been carrying it since about 2008, and it just really just exploded. There was about 8,000 cars carrying it in 2008. 2013, there are 400,000 of them carrying it. They just finally admitted that, oh, look, these things are basically the equivalent of bomb trains. So that's really what I've been covering, the fallout from that explosion and the discussions around making more safe tank cars and regulations and just watching it all unfold in the first couple of weeks of the new year.
Steve, let me ask you this. I mean, this has gotten to be about as common as school shootings. How many have we had in the last 3 months?
Well, we've had three explosions, actually, in the past 3 months. There's one in Alabama. There was one in – another one in Canada, actually, in a place called Plaster Rock, which is in New Brunswick province. And then there was the one in Castleton, North Dakota. And then four in the past half year, if you include the huge one in Lake Megantic, Quebec, where 47 people – passed away or vaporized immediately by these explosive cars. So that they're happening with more and more frequency as the traffic picks up with more and more oil being carried on these trains.
Now, so it's not just the tankers now. It's not just the pipelines. We've got this is a multi-vector danger that, of course, we've been assured that this is all very safe and the regulations is all in place. Have you heard any news on the Arkansas spill?
Well, yeah. The Arkansas spill, of course, is a pipeline spill of carrying tar sands from Alberta. This one in North Dakota was oil obtained from fracking in the Bakken Shale Basin. So a little bit different substance. That's a key distinction. It's a lighter oil from North Dakota, kind of more like a gasoline. But even so, we'll compare the two. Gasoline has about 18% of its chemical composition is volatile organic compounds such as benzene, toluene, others. Bakken shale oil, so 18% for gasoline is 40% of the substance is those volatile organic compounds, which means that depending on the temperature and its surroundings, it could very easily cause one of these explosions. And so these are what are going around the United States. And the Bakken Shale is unique because, there's really not a lot of pipeline infrastructure. 70% of the oil from the Bakken Shale is carried via freight rail cars. So, and it's only going to increase over time, at least for now, as the public lands of North Dakota get more and more opened up. And there was a key bill passed, again, right before the new year, actually four days before this explosion, a bill was passed, signed by President Obama, but on December 20th, passed by both chambers of Congress to expedite permitting for public lands in North Dakota. So these trains certainly aren't going away anytime soon.
Now, are these, where is the responsibility on these? Is there a hold harmless kind of law that allows these guys to ship this stuff and we pick up the tab, or is there some modest actual billing that falls on these dangerous shippers?
Well, yeah, so rail car works in a really unique way compared to a pipeline even. More and more, it's more of a Wild West situation. It's not very hard to get a permit to carry almost anything on a freight rail car because of old tradition in the United States legal system called the Common Carrier Law, where rail cars are treated basically just as something that help facilitate the movement of everything, and that includes now oil, it includes coal, it includes nuclear waste, all kinds of stuff that isn't really talked about a lot but is definitely hazardous, and they don't really have to go through much of a permitting process to be able to carry the stuff. And so that's what happened here. In terms of who's liable, it would be a two-part thing. It would be the rail industry works in an interesting way. There's the actual owner of the entire, like there's 120 train car or 120 unit car, one company would own that whole thing. So maybe Burlington Northern Santa Fe, in the case of Castleton, North Dakota, they own that whole thing. Well, within that whole thing, each individual car on that 120 car train will be owned by a different tank car company. So companies like Union Tank Car, American Rail Car, et cetera. In this case, it's interesting because BNSF is owned by Warren Buffett. So this was he owned this train. He also owns a large stake in Union Tank Car, which so it's really double dips in the rail industry, and that's what makes him such a powerful individual. So in this case, it would be these companies and in a way the federal government for allowing this to happen. So the Department of Transportation is what oversees the rail industry.
Thank you. Are you tracking the fast tracking of TPP?
I certainly am. Yeah, and the environmental section was leaked by WikiLeaks this week, and obviously I think that a lot of people watching it closely won't be surprised that anything that talks about environmental protections in the TPP is mostly public relations, all voluntary on the part of corporations to comply with any of their recommendations. Because really, the TPP does something so unbelievable that it basically gets rid of the power of a nation state for on behalf of global multinational corporations. So, of course, these multinational corporations don't want to comply with any environmental regulations or anything. So what this does is says, well, here are some best practices. Here's what you can do, you know, if you want to. But there's no, they're not legally held to it. Do that, and so they're probably not going to do it. So this environmental section, as interesting as it is, basically, it's like a wild, wild west type of situation where these corporations can do whatever they want and not have to comply with any international norms or standards for, right, you know, and anything that may hurt the environment. And that's the scary thing about the TPP, on top of everything else the TPP does, which is a long, long list.
Yeah. There's stories floating around that the president's under additional pressure to wave through the XL pipeline. Have you heard anything on that front?
I have been reading the news on the Keystone XL, and it's really interesting because I'm in Washington, D.C. about to fly back to Madison, and the Canadian government is on a hard push right now. It shows really how owned the Canadian government is by this tar sands industry. One of the stations close to the State Department who has the final say, along with Obama, on that Keystone XL northern half, is basically a bunch of advertisements from the government saying why tar sands are good for energy independence and good for America and Canada. And so I've seen that Canadian officials have come out and said that they hope that it gets expedited. They're moved along really quickly at the beginning of 2014. I see the TransCanada CEO has been saying a lot about how he thinks it will just be a few weeks. So there's certainly quite a bit of pressure on both the State Department and the Obama administration, both by TransCanada and the Canadian government, to ram through this thing at the beginning of this year.
Well, excellent, sir. What's your what article are you working on next?
These days, what am I working on these days? I'm working on continuing to follow what happens with the push to regulate the rail industry and watchdog it more closely by regulatory agencies with the fallout of that Pock and Shale oil explosion. And certainly watching the Keystone XL northern half, the debate over that closely. And then I'm, you know, on top of all this, the broader context, I'm watching the oil exports debate that's happening in Washington, D.C., because that's the common thread between the Keystone XL and these rail cars, is the exportation of Canadian and American oil to the global market, basically. So any talk that you hear about energy independence is basically a bunch of BS, because the industry is pushing very hard for exports to Asian countries, to any country, whoever can pay the most for it. And that's a big push. So I'm watching it all and just looking at how these things all relate to one another.
Thank you so much, Steve. You have a safe trip, okay?
Thanks a lot.
And stay warm. Bye-bye.
I'll try. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Luis Cuevas. Luis, welcome.
Hey, how you doing, brother?
Very good, sir. Very good. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Well, it's been, for us progressives, it's been a target-rich environment this last few weeks, the first weeks of 2014. So let me ask you one of the big questions, sir. What was your reaction to the president's NSA speech?
I got to control that, but let me say that I wasn't surprised. I think that he has bought into the whole establishment operation of this. It is obvious that there is a system out there which pretty much controls what is going on. And when the president talks about these reforms, which kind of many have said that, oh, well, it's a start. Well, you start somewhere, but where are you going? And what exactly do you mean to do? But we have powers that be that have been there for too many years. And the political establishment, when you think about it, presidents come and go. and so do elected officials. But there is always a mass of all these unelected people, this bureaucracy that stays in place. And it seldom change. And so when you look at it, there is, you know, after 8 years of the Bush administration, most of those people are still there. Most of these people, whether they are, you know, the upper, let's say, echelon, like Hayes and so on, have moved on, but not quite. But they have people in there, whether you want to call them moles, whether you want to call them accessory to the Cheney Bush, you know, cadre. Then, you know, that's another thing. But they're there. You know, the one thing that we know that the Obama administration has not done is replace a number of positions in government and filled out hundreds of positions in government, so that you have an element that is still there that is pretty much self-serving. It's of the mentality of people like Hayes and Gates, and if you remember good old Poindexter.
Oh yeah,
Admiral Poindexter. And point, you know, for all this talk we talk about the NSA today, it was Hayes of the CIA who got Poindexter to go into a basement room at the NSA and then put together this system for this massive data gathering. And when it began to come out that this was going on, they quickly got rid of Poindexter and put him out to pasture. But that has, you know, that was in there. And
it continues to roll.
Exactly. And when you look at the big picture, you know, it's something that continues and it's not ending, it's self-serving. And the most, I think the most vile part of the whole thing is that thanks to the Reagan-Bush administrations, all three of them, we got this system whereby private contractors, corporations,
standalone, off the shelf.
Yes.
Yep.
I mean, they have all these contracts for the national security. Mercenaries.
Right.
Hired by the U.S. government, and not only do they serve the U.S. government, they sell themselves with the same information.
Yep.
You know, and so this is all going on at the same time. And let me tell you one thing. If you look at our own political system, how this is being affected by the whole thing, right now, if you are going to look at how the political parties obtain their information for the GOTV movements, they go to these private corporations that know everything that's to be known about everyone in this country.
Yep.
Who's registered to vote. And they can tell you whether you have a new motorcycle in your home.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what magazine subscriptions you have at home. You know, how many people are living in your home, who's registered to what party. All of this information is out there. This is all being bought and sold without permission from any one of us.
Luis, you're going to stay with us, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Let me bring on Carl.
Excellent.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Carl, how are you, sir? Hello? Carl, are you with us?
Yes, I am with you. Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes, I can. Yes, I can. Great. So welcome.
Excellent.
Sir. Welcome. Glad you could join us.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me on the program. Really excited to be here.
Sure. Carl, tell us, what stories are you working on right now?
Well, you know, I just came from West Virginia. I was in Charleston, and a little community about an hour south of Charleston called Van, West Virginia. Little town of about 1,000 people. And I got two very different opinions from people on the future of the coal industry in West Virginia. And I think West Virginia is going through a grand awakening period right now. I think this water crisis is the thing that might get West Virginians to rethink where their energy comes from.
Well, they can live without mountains. They just can't live without water.
Yeah, and they don't. One of them was telling me they didn't even realize, you know, how much we need water until you live without it, or how much that you actually use in a given day.
Well, I did a story on our opening that I'd read about how the bankruptcy is going to allow basically the owners to shuffle some paperwork and rescue themselves out of bankruptcy while simultaneously protecting their assets. That was one story. And the other story was that some of the people being provided water are complaining that the water they're getting, quote, as the rescue water, smells just as bad as the other water. What were you hearing on the ground?
So I was on the ground when I was in Van. Van had just had their water ban lifted that morning when I arrived. And so what I wanted to do was get people who were flushing out their hot and cold water. And when I talked to a guy, he had turned on his faucet for me, and he said it smelled like candy, and he was describing the smell for me. The water itself, it was murky and kind of filmy, and when you let it sit there in a glass, bubbles would cling to the side of the glass. And even if you switched around the glass of water really hard, the bubbles would still stay put. So there's some kind of weird chemical mixture that was in the water that they said was safe to drink after they had lifted the ban. And the water had a very licorice-like aroma to it. And so, when I talked to the guy who, by the way, said he had worked in the coal industry his entire life and loved coal and had provided for his grandparents and his parents and for him, he said it would be a really long time before he let any of his kids drink a glass of that tap water. That was coming out of that sink. You know, they're all continuing to use bottled water. Even in Charleston, who had their ban lifted when I was there, it had been about 5 or 6 days since the water ban had been lifted, but nobody was drinking or bathing in the water. So essentially 300,000 people are still without their water. And also I would add to the details that you mentioned, Rick, is that Freedom Industries, the company that spilled the chemical, they've only been in legal existence for a couple weeks now. And so a lot of people that I talked to were kind of speculating the real purpose of Freedom Industries, because they had gone into bankruptcy almost as soon as they had spilled the chemical, and they'd spilled the chemical almost as soon as they had gone into business. So it all has a really weird smell to it. So I'm kind of peeling back layers of this onion, and I'm more surprised at new details I find.
Well, you know, I was chasing a story about some solid waste facilities and some of the noxious gas coming off there. And I was assured by the environmental engineer working on the project that, listen, this was not going to be a problem because they had some perfume they were going to start spraying. And when you said it smells like candy, you know, of course, there's some petroleum smells that smell that way. But I'm wondering if in the quote, cleanup process in trying to, you know, change the smell of it, they're using something like that as well. I think that this problem is going to be around for a while for them to bankrupt themselves two or three different times. I also saw another story where people were saying that the smell started appearing in the water well before Christmas.
Yeah, I hadn't particularly heard anything about that. What I do know is, you know, the response on the ground to this spill from the people inside the communities and the people who care about the natural resources of their state. I was talking to one guy, Dustin White, from the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. He's an organizer out in the Charleston area. He was telling me that they are working on petitioning under the SMACRA Act, which I think is a Surface Mining and Reclamation Act, something like that, law passed in the 70s, saying that if the state fails to properly regulate the coal industry, that the people have the right to step in and regulate it themselves. And clearly what's going on is that the state government, Governor Tomlin, and the state legislature are refusing to acknowledge their failed regulation of the coal industry. And so what the people are doing is saying, we're going to take on that regulation responsibility ourselves. And so it's kind of a really inspiring story of people, you know, stepping up and, you know, looking after their natural resources when their local and state governments won't.
Hey, let me ask you a question. Something that I've never seen anyone mention was, who is it that's footing the bill for the imported water? Is it the good citizens of West
Virginia? I would assume it's the federal government, because I know the FEMA and National Guard are down there handing out water. Somebody's paying for that water.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Lewis.
Yes, one of the things is that the Homeland sent out 16 18-wheelers full of water, socialist water for Charleston.
Good job, buddy. So, Carl, listen, I think someone should be making an issue. Isn't it generous of us as taxpayers to be bailing out the woeful mistreatment of the waters of West Virginia by this, you know, whatever you want to call it, Freedom Industries, Justice Industries, we're just here to do good things industries?
It's kind of a big blow in the face of the small government argument, right? Because now big government has to come in and bail out West Virginia and, you know, give them water to drink and bathe in. I mean, water is such a basic need. And the fact that their lack of regulation has led to such a crisis, now they have to depend on, you know, the government to come together. That's why I don't mind paying taxes for public services, because I think it's the duty of taxpayers to look out for one another in our country. And, you know, I would much rather have my tax dollars going towards providing water for people who need it as opposed to, you know, bailing out banks or the fossil fuel industry or, you know, for wars.
I completely appreciate what you're saying. Because I agree with you. But on the other hand, I think that when we let these jokers off scot-free, we are underwriting their malfeasance. And that's the part that bugs me.
Yeah. I have a question, and that's, you know,
go ahead, Lewis.
Who is going to do the cleanup? Because actually what they're doing is they're saying, oh, well, this is going to go down the river, and this is going to dilute. Well, it's not quite, because every city down the river is now on a watch because they're receiving the same damage from these folks. I asked my wife, who happens to be an organic chemist, about this, this, and it's a compound, what they're using. And one of the compounds causes liver problems, including liver cancer. And the other compound is similar to throwing gasoline in the water. So whichever way you look at it, it is a toxic material. It's a solvent to separate the coal, you know, to wash the coal when it comes out for processing. And they're putting all this stuff out there. Actually, there were reports when this whole thing broke out that there was this licorice smell in the air. And so, the local people, the local agency came in, they went to check. They were told, oh, no, everything is fine. They got a whiff of the smell and said, let's look at it. And they saw that this thing was welling out, you know, and then going into the river. Yeah, and they cannot account for how much of it actually went out there.
Carl, let me ask you another question. Now, it seems to me that probably the West Virginia government isn't overfunding their water treatment processes. And I can readily imagine that choking through, oh, let's just guess, several million gallons worth of some solvent probably didn't do that water plant any good at all. I'm wondering if the good people of Freedom Industries will be writing a check to the water department to upgrade that water processing plant now that they've had to choke through all that chemistry.
You know, I can't imagine they will, since they filed for bankruptcy. Their parent company is partially owned by Koch Industries, which has, you know, plenty of money to spare. I think clearly they need to be paying for the cleanup and not leading any part of the cleanup. You know, I was in Mississippi covering the oil spill in 2010. And what I learned from letting the same company who spilled the oil clean it up is that they will totally pour in so many harmful toxic chemicals into their own spill to make it sink to the bottom of the ocean so it'll be out of sight, out of mind, and people will stop talking about it. You know, I think they're more concerned about their corporate image, and, of course, the parent companies who run Freedom Industries really want this thing to you know, pass in the media. I think if I was a responsible elected official in the government of West Virginia – I would demand an invoice for every cleanup effort, and I would send all those invoices to Freedom Industries' parent company and demand that they, you know, reimburse it immediately. So I don't know if they'll do that because Governor Tomlin and most of the Democrats and Republicans in West Virginia's legislature have their pockets lined by the coal companies. You know, it's a very insidious process. So, I mean, until you really address the root of that problem, which is where the campaign money comes from, I wouldn't really expect any serious action from the state government, unfortunately.
Was there were there noises being made in the Charleston papers or television that they were going to make sure, or was it more like, don't worry, everything's okay, pat, pat, pat?
I think they were really eager to get this behind them because it's bringing a lot of bad PR to not just Freedom Industries, but to, you know, Charleston and the state government as well. I mean, they're acknowledging with new legislation, and because their legislators are in session right now, they're introducing new bills to regulate chemical storage facilities, but nothing involving coal. And so they're trying to section it off as much as possible for this one company and this one spill, rather than address the systemic issue of dependence on this outdated fossil fuel.
Okay, let me. That was wonderful, and I really appreciate that, Carl. Let me take you in another direction just for a minute. I want to ask each of my guests to weigh in on the president's NSA speech. Did you get a chance to catch it?
Yeah, I did. I think it was basically Obama saying, "Hey, so Snowden embarrassed us, and yeah, we're spying on everybody, so we're going to put a Band-Aid on it, and Snowden should still go to jail." I mean, that's pretty much what I gleaned from Obama's speech. It's kind of I think it's kind of systemic of the problem that, you know, the people who finance the Democratic Party are largely these big tech industry guys in California, and they really make a killing off of the surveillance industry. So, you know, if Obama were to call for serious reforms to the surveillance state, he would be pissing off the entire fundraising base of the Democratic Party. So, I mean, he's treading carefully. I think it's unfortunate that he didn't call for really serious action. He really just addressed that it was a problem and that, you know, they're going to still continue doing it and find loopholes around the law so they can still collect our data. I mean, I think we really need a big rethinking of, you know, of people's rights in the inside the Beltway crowd.
Well, you know, like the president reminded us, they're just our neighbors, you know, and their kids are on Facebook just like ours. And after all, you know, when you use your debit card, you're telling everybody everything anyway. And as Lewis pointed out, the politicians are going to big corporations' databases. So, hey, isn't it all fair that we all just share one database? It's just that transparency ends at that office door of the government. That's all.
I mean, I would summarize it with one of my favorite quotes from Dwight Eisenhower, that big government Republican. he said, you know, if you want total security, go to prison. There you're fed, clothed, given medical care, and so on. The only thing lacking is freedom. You know, I think Eisenhower would be rolling in his grave if he knew that, you know, this is how far the military-industrial complex had progressed in our society.
Carl, are you going to be able to stay with us?
Yeah, I sure can.
Okay, great, because let me bring on our next guest. I'd like to bring on Jerry Waxman. Jerry, welcome.
Hi, how are you, Rick?
Pretty good, buddy, pretty good. And yourself?
Oh, not too bad. Caught a bit of a cold. I'm calling you from my sick bed, but I'll survive.
Well, you're a generous man. Happy New Year to you. Jer, what stories are you working on right now?
Well, there's a whole host of stories that are happening here in Central Florida with the Expressway Commission and a couple of other things. I find it rather ironic that this is the Martin Luther King Day weekend, and that's when Chris Christie chose to come down to raise money for Rick Scott from a whole bunch of Florida billionaires. I don't think he expected the backlash from his George Washington Bridge scandal, because that has put a little bit of a crimp into their plans, but that's not really local news. I'm still working on the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
So, of course, I'm sure you've heard that they've got that fast track submitted now, S-1000 and H.R. 3830,
yeah.
Max Baucus,
yeah,
and Dave Camp. So far, I understand they only have a very few sponsors.
That's absolutely correct. And then Harry Reid threw a monkey wrench in their plans as well.
Oh, no.
Because, oh, yeah.
It was actually a statement from Silent Harry?
He said it's not coming to the floor.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So, at least
trouble
not
in Oz,
yet.
Huh?
Yeah, not, we don't know how long that's going to last, but, I mean, there are forces at work against it. And, of course, every day or every week it seems that another part of another document is leaked, and every time they are leaked, it's worse than the one before. So popular sentiment is turning this thing into it's going to be a real showdown. If the thing is going to come to the floor, it probably won't pass, but that's not good enough. We have to make sure that it doesn't even come to the floor, at least not this session. But that's basically the story I'm working on.
Okay. I've been asking everybody for their reaction to the president's speech on NSA. Now that we know that the NSA is just our friends and neighbors whose kids are on Facebook. Did you catch the speech, or what was your reaction?
No, I really didn't catch the speech. However, I did read stuff on it. He said what I think he had to say, but nothing's going to change. Nothing, you know, he's going to keep it where it is. The coalitions he's building up are too fragile, and there are still too many members of Congress that are so for the NSA spying that I don't see any sensible solution to this problem during this congressional period. We're going to have to wait until after the elections in 2014 before you're going to see any kind of progress made on it.
Well, I caught this little piece of an interview of Glenn Greenwald talking about trusting the government. And let me play you this quick little clip.
You don't trust, plainly don't trust, all of the security chiefs who've lined up to say that what you've done, the stories you've written, have fundamentally undermined security and aided and abetted terrorism. I'll just point you to the evidence of Oliver Robbins, the Deputy National Security Advisor for Intelligence in the UK Cabinet Office, who says, and he said this in written evidence in a court case, it is known that in the seized material is personal information that would allow intelligence staff to be identified, including those deployed overseas. He says the government has had to assume that copies of information held by Mr. Snowden may now be held by one or more other states. You're saying he is not telling the truth.
There was this thing called the Iraq War, in which the U.S. and the U.K. governments persuaded their media outlets and their populations to support an aggressive attack on another country by making one false claim after the next designed to scare the population into believing that there was a security threat that didn't actually exist, that they had to go to war in order to stop. What journalism is about is it's based on the premise that when people like Mr. Robbins and others who exercise power in the dark make those kinds of claims to justify their own power, they're often lying. They often tell things to the population that turns out to be untrue. And the job of a journalist is not to investigate other journalists who are investigating those powerful officials. It's to try and be responsible when telling their viewers and readers what government officials are saying, and then to assess whether there's evidence for it. That's my role as a journalist. You don't have to rely on my statement.
You are saying something so explosive, I have to challenge it. You're accusing the most senior intelligence officials on both sides of the Atlantic of routine and systematic lying. What is your evidence? You say, look at the Iraq War, but what is your evidence that when people like the head of GCHQ and the head of MI6 say that there is real evidence that since your revelations, the sorts of communications conducted by terrorists has changed because they've adapted to what they've learned from you, where is your evidence those intelligence chiefs are lying?
First of all, I think the Iraq War is a pretty significant example of the propensity of...
If you want to
scream at me and make all kinds of filibustering remarks, I can just disconnect and you can do that. But if you want to ask me a question, you're going to give me time to actually answer it. The evidence that government officials lie is found in history with things like the Iraq War, when the U.S. and the U.K. destroyed a country of 26 million people based on lies they told over the course of 2 years to their population. And if you look at what happens in countries where there's constitutional guarantees of a free press, which I know doesn't include the U.K. but includes most Western democracies, what you find is all sorts of people who have created those protections have done so based on the recognition that people in power, specifically national security officials, will routinely lie to their population. The evidence that I have is that three Democratic senators just 2 weeks ago in the United States who are on the Intelligence Committee and have access to classified information came out and said that the claims of NSA officials and others that these programs have stopped terrorist plots is completely false, that there is no evidence for it.
I think he's not really suggesting that they're lying. It's just that they're saying the least truthful thing they could think of at the time.
Well, it seems to me that anybody who is protecting the NSA from what's coming out has some kind of a vested interest in doing it. One of the chief defenders of our spying program is Dianne Feinstein.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm concerned, she's one of the dirtiest people in Congress. And I don't believe a word she ever says. I believe everything she says is to feather her own nest, protect her husband at all costs, and, help him stay a billionaire. It has nothing to do with national security. But that's only my opinion.
Okay. Let me ask you this. We see peace efforts in Syria, we see peace efforts in Iran, we see peace efforts again in Palestine and Israel. Do you give any of these much hope?
Say that again. I didn't quite understand
what I was getting
you...
at is there are we see the Iran situation evolving, we see the Syria position evolving, and we see again some small efforts toward peace in Palestine and Israel. I was wondering if you give any of those much hope.
I give every one of them hope if people are serious about peace. They have been fighting and fighting and fighting for I don't know how many generations. With the state of Israel now, 60 years old or 65 years old or whatever it is, it's still going to take another couple generations before there's some kind of complete peace in the Middle East. That's just human nature. But, yes, it does have a chance if people are willing to cooperate. And nobody thought 40 years ago that Jimmy Carter could broker peace between Egypt and Israel. And he did. So, yeah, there's a tremendous chance. It's a matter of not believing the Dick Cheneys of the world and committing ourselves to really getting peace.
Chair, are you going to be able to stay with us for our roundtable?
Of course.
Good, good. Let me bring on our last guest for the roundtable, and then after a few minutes, we'll get the whole group talking together. Hold on 1 second. I'd like to introduce Mr. Alan Maki.
Hi, Alan, how
are you
welcome.
Doing? Very good, sir. And yourself?
I'm doing good.
Alan, I saw that email you sent out today calling on a good Senator Bernie Sanders to do a little more than he's done. Would you talk a little bit about that, sir? I think it was an excellent letter.
Well, yeah, I think Bernie has to do a little more than he's done. After all, he's the only socialist sitting in the United States Congress, and he should be bringing forward socialist solutions to some of the problems that we're having. And I think it's important, he's been pushing this whole idea of an economic populism that's more or less like what we get from Robert Reich or Joe Stiglitz or any of these other pundits and so-called economists. But from Bernie, I think we are going to have to see a whole lot more in the way of standing up and saying the government's got to become responsible for attaining and maintaining full employment, and that we need a minimum wage that's a real living wage, not another poverty wage. Talking about $10 an hour, $9.50 an hour. These are poverty wages. And people are entitled to real living wages in this country. This is the richest country in the world, and I think Bernie has a responsibility to be bringing this all out. He's also been very weak on the whole question of funding Israel, the Israeli killing machine, and even militarism and wars. His letter did not refer at all. He says he's holding this national forum, a telephone conference to talk about the economy and everything. But he doesn't even mention the effects of militarism and wars on our economy. These wars are killing our jobs, they're killing our livelihoods, just like they kill people. And we got to hear Bernie start to talk like this, like a real socialist.
Thank you. That was a wonderful thought. And I, like I say, I thought your email message was dead on, just like so many of yours. Sir, let me ask you another question. Is there another issue that you're looking at right now as a paramount concern? You know, always we have so many troubling issues before us. What else is getting your attention these days?
Well, the main thing is the minimum wage. Here in Minnesota, we have a Democratic supermajority. We have a Democratic governor. We have the Democrats are now the dominant force in the state Senate and in the state House. And all these Democrats campaigned on a theme of raising the minimum wage to a living wage. Now that they've been elected, they're talking about things like $8 and $8.50 and $9 an hour, raising the minimum wage from $6.15 an hour. Minnesota has one of the lowest minimum wages in the country. We've already had one legislative session go by with this Democratic supermajority, and they didn't raise the minimum wage a plug nickel. And yet they brought forward this. They had a blitz, actually, pushing a new Viking stadium, a $1 billion Viking stadium for the Viking football team, professional football team. They pushed the stadium down taxpayers' throats to the tune of $1 billion, and they didn't raise the minimum wage a single penny. And we're trying to bring pressure on the Democrats now to raise the minimum wage to a real living wage. And we're telling these Democrats, you know, don't throw these figures around without explaining to us where you're getting the figures from. After all, there's only one thing working people can compare wages to, and that's the cost of living, what they can buy with the wages that they earn. And there's no way that anybody can survive in this country on $9 an hour. And we've got to get the minimum wage up to a real living wage. It should actually be tied to all cost of living factors calculated by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And this is what we're pushing for, a minimum wage that is legislatively tied to the cost of living, then indexed to inflation. These people are talking about indexing the poverty wage that they want to bring forward to inflation. But what good does it do to index a poverty wage to inflation? You still end up with a poverty wage. We need to start with a real living minimum wage in this country. And that's what we expect from these Democrats with their supermajority.
Well, thank you, sir. I'm going to go ahead and start the roundtable. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to raise a topic, and I'd like you each to wave in on it. While I know that, you know, you don't get a chance to investigate each of these, but I know you're intelligent people. You think about things. You think about the impact of these issues. So I'd just like to each to wave in on it. And I'm going to start, Carl, with you. And I'm going to say, Carl, I'm sure you've heard about that terrible ruling that right for now means the end of net neutrality. Have you heard about it? Have you done any thinking about it? What's your reaction to that situation, sir? And what do you think the impact is going to be? Go ahead and start with you, Carl.
Yeah, sure. It's very troubling for sure. I mean, we all know that AT&T and Verizon and these telecoms companies are, you know, donating heavily to both parties to ensure that, you know, net neutrality will be dismantled so they can, you know, really control and monopolize the Internet, which is the next economy. So it's really dangerous. It sets a bad precedent. It's not over yet, though. If the FCC, you know, will take action and, you know, and stop that court ruling, which they have the authority to do, then it might be a different story. But what we really need to be doing is putting pressure on all of the FCC commissioners. We need to be inundating them with calls, with letters, with emails. We need to just take up every waking moment of all the FCC commissioners' days with our requests to keep net neutrality strong. I think we need to also build up public awareness about net neutrality, because when you say net neutrality to the average person, they don't really know what that means. But if you frame it as companies making websites run slower than others, then, you know, people understand that that's messed up. That's a really easy way to crack down on independent investigative journalism that's mostly run online, that these companies
exactly.
don't want out. I mean, it has so many disastrous impacts.
Thank you so much. Luis, let me ask you, sir, the same thing. And net neutrality, what do you think is going to come from that if we can't turn it around?
Well, that's the I agree with Carl on this, that essentially what they're doing is trying to turn this whole thing over to a privatized system that is going to essentially go out there and say, it's going to cost you so much. And then they're going to block just about everything that doesn't fit their interest. So that means that it's not only access, but it's also freedom of expression that is threatened by these monopolies. Well, you know, essentially we got the trust system in the Internet.
Yep. Thank you, sir. Jerry, how about you? Have you thought about net neutrality as an issue?
Yeah, I have. As a matter of fact, my contract is up for renewal, and they want me to upgrade my phone, and I said to them, why should I? You're trying to keep me off the Internet. I'm going to go with Credo. And they said, oh, no, we let's talk. We'll give you a better price. I said, it's not a matter of price. It's a matter of I don't agree with your politics. So I don't know where we are yet. You know, I've been with Verizon since before they were Verizon, and as far as the service, I'm satisfied with the service and all that. I'm not satisfied with the price. My wife pays $40 a month less than I do for the same service with AT&T. But as far as net neutrality, I think Congress has to step in also. You know, the FCC, the laws haven't been changed governing broadcasts and things like that probably since the advent of television. I think the laws need to be updated, and I think people absolutely have to get involved. Otherwise, they are going to lose what little freedom they have right now of expression.
Thank you. Alan?
Yeah. I think it's important for people to understand net neutrality is a lot like affirmative action. Net neutrality means that we create a level playing field for everybody using the Internet and the websites and Internet technologies. And if we lose that, we lose our freedom of speech, and, you know, we can't allow this to happen. This is one more instance where, you know, Obama campaigned on the basis of supporting net neutrality, and he baited us with that. And now that he's president, he's pulled this switch. He's doing nothing to promote net neutrality, and he's turning everything over to the corporations. It's the same thing with everything else. They want to privatize everything, and they think the answer to every problem in this country is to privatize and let the market determine what happens. And the American taxpayers have subsidized this Internet to the hilt, and I believe that the Internet should be owned by the government. And it should probably come under the Postal Service, and the Postal Service should become our Internet service provider, and that would take care of the situation, I think. But we've got to defend our right to have access to the Internet.
Yeah, I think that the if we were to suffer the fate of the complete end of net neutrality, you'd see a Disney, Microsoft, Google Internet with just corporate big guns on the high-speed Internet, and then the rest of us also ran, especially political commentary and the counterculture news, would be relegated to such a slow lane that it would be basically the ghetto of the web. Absolutely. Okay, another story that doesn't get much coverage in the mainstream press is Fukushima. So let me reverse this, and we'll start with Alan this time. Alan, you have any thoughts on Fukushima?
I sure do. It's a terrible situation, and we've been lied to by the Japanese government. We've been lied to by our own government. And, you know, the capitalist corporations have pushed dilution as the solution to any kind of environmental disaster, and that's what we're seeing with Fukushima. You know, we're going to be eating this radiation for decades to come. We don't even know. The government's not telling us how dangerous the situation actually is. The people haven't been kept informed. They're talking now about doing experiments about what happens when you have a nuclear meltdown. Well, why haven't they done these experiments before they ever built a single one of these nuclear power plants? You know, everything is being done backwards, everything for the sake of profits, and this is a terrible situation. It could turn into a total disaster that can, you know, literally wipe millions of people off the face of the earth.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. Jerry, your thoughts?
I agree in total with that assessment. I am one of these people who is totally against using nuclear power to run our domestic industries or to heat our homes or anything else, because there is no absolute safe way to guarantee that we aren't going to get hurt. I used to live in Pennsylvania. I lived 90 miles away from Three Mile Island. So we were right there involved in that fiasco, and that was, 35 years ago, 36 years ago. Yeah. I'm very well aware of it, and I agree in total. We got to get rid of nuclear power, and it may not hurt us today, but it's going to kill future generations.
Yep. The news story I did today was, again, a new high in radiation levels found outside the plant. Thanks. Louis, next, sir. Fukushima.
Yes. What you have here is operating is a corporate state. And the Japanese have gotten very good at it. And, of course, what you had there with TEPCO, that corporation that controls all these nuclear plants, is that actually the government owns 60% of it. And so the government is going to bail out all the other investors who are involved in that whole thing. And what they want to do is not only play games with this Fukushima plant and all the malfeasance that is going on in there. As some reports have come out, is that they're using actually people who are unemployed, jobless, homeless, and all that to do cleanup work. On the other hand, they're ready to fire up 14 more nuclear plants, all of which were in doubt in terms of what they were doing. And then when you look at this, what they are trying to do and what they're pushing, if you look at the other reports that are coming out, is that the nuclear industry is losing money because all the other alternatives are by far producing more profit, and the renewable industries are pushing far much better results and much cheaper. And so all these vested interests are right now trying to do everything they can to revive this failure of an industry. And Alan and Jerry said before, what you have here is an insurance industry that might not have any problems for some time, but when you do, wait, you see Three Mile Island, and then we look at what happened in Russia, Japan, that's it.
Thank you, sir. Carl, I know you follow the petroleum industry very closely. Any thoughts on Fukushima?
Yeah, I don't know if you guys had read this. The Japanese government actually outsourced Fukushima cleanup to the Yakuza, to the mob.
Right.
And the Yakuza then paid homeless people to go in there and carry spent nuclear rods out of the building. And then those homeless people reported high levels of radiation. I think a couple of them actually died or were hospitalized for radiation poisoning. It's like everything that you could do wrong with a nuclear site cleanup, the Japanese government's doing it in spades. And I think people make the argument that, we got to have electricity, we got to have power. Nuclear power is, puts less CO2 in the air than coal and it's less harmful to water than fracking. And, on the surface, that's true. But all it takes is, like you guys mentioned, is for one plant to mess up. whether it's Fukushima or Three Mile Island or Chernobyl, and, you know, all that is kaput, you know, and just like in, I was just in Seattle and, Oregon and the West Coast a couple months ago, everybody was telling me, they're like, dude, don't step foot in the Pacific Ocean because you're going to come out with like six toes or something. You know, it's like, so we really need to be mindful of how we get our power. And like the other panelists have said, there are so many alternatives out there, and we really don't need to depend on nuclear. That's, it's a false green solution. We really need to look into building a new renewable energy grid. I mean, think of all the jobs that could create, as well as the savings to the future generations and having an environment to grow up in.
You know, I have a relative who's in the nuclear industry, and he goes, Richard, you just can't be against science. I said, you know, science I'm not against. Sloppy, commercialized science where the only thing that's important is the profit, that's what I'm against. I have a friend who's doing he's a videographer for German public television, and he gets to go on to the Fukushima site many times, and he told me last summer about the Yakuza hiring or collecting street people. Another story he mentioned was that when these poor street people, their radiation meters show that they've had too much exposure, they solve that problem quite easily. They just hand out new badges. And he also mentioned that the area around Fukushima, because the soil was contaminated down about 3 inches, they've been scraping the soil up. Well, then they couldn't figure out where they're going to put it, so they just had these huge mounds of dirt blowing around in that vicinity. So essentially, they've localized the pollution to then spread it around by the wind. They've got some real troubles there, and we're not going to see the end of that for quite some time. I just hope that there's enough good science on this side of the Pacific, and then hopefully the UN gets involved in trying to get this cleanup, because it's got to be taken out of both Japan and TEPCO's hands. It's clearly not doing anything good. Another interesting story that I wanted to have you all weigh in on was the story about cheaters and stoners with their fingers on the nuclear missiles. So I'm going to start with you, Carl, on that one. Have you heard that story?
With cheaters and stoners on their fingers on nuclear missiles?
Yeah. They've evidently just detected a bunch of people in the missile silos out in, I think it's North Dakota and I think South Dakota as well, where they found like 35 or 40 people who cheated on their tests, and they also uncovered a drug ring there. Now, I'm all for people being able to control their consciousness. I am. I think that's important. I think it's a human right. I'm not so sure that being stoned while you're running a nuclear missile is probably a good idea. So, Carl, have you heard about that or not?
I mean, I haven't heard about that, although I do like the phrase being in control of your own consciousness as a human right. That's excellent framing. I need to remember that. I remember when I was driving through Montana on my way out west in September, and my friend I was driving with was telling me he used to live out there. He said there's all these missile silos out in Montana, and, you know, they were installed during the Cold War, and all people need to do is push a button. And then I got me thinking, it's like, wow, there are people whose jobs are all day to sit by a button, a beautiful, shiny red button. They probably just, you know, like to let their fingers sink in about halfway on the button before it's depressed all the way. I can't imagine having having drug-addled people that, you know, deploy nuclear missiles for on behalf of our country. This is certainly a scary thought. I mean, that's all the more reason we just need to disable those missile silos altogether. I mean, nuclear war would really, I mean, everyone else has nuclear missiles as well. I mean, it's like a Quentin Tarantino-style Mexican standoff, you know, at Reservoir Dogs or Inglourious Bastards. We all got our guns pointed at each other. As soon as someone pulls the trigger, everybody's dead. I mean, we just need to get rid of nuclear missiles. I don't know why we haven't already.
Absolutely. Thank you. Lewis.
Yeah, that, you know, this is a, if you remember that Peter Sellers movie, where they have all these
Dr. Strangelove,
yes, and you're looking at Slim Pickens writing that, you know, that nuclear weapon on the way down. Well, you know, it's deranged. It's what we're having here. It just happens that first they catch a general who has been doing alcohol to the extreme, who happens to be connected with this system, then they find out that there is a drug habit among many of the those people who are supposed to be able to be ready, at the ready, conscious to turn the keys for the nuclear weapons. There's two pairs, always, to do the job, and then just in case somebody fails to do it, and then on top of it, when they catch it, and I think it was 20-something, then they begin to find out that every year they're giving a test to see their, check their qualifications on this job, and that they are ready to do it and how they can do it. And it's so they find out that they've been texting the answers to each other all the time. So they, I mean, this is massive.
Where was the NSA on that one, huh?
Yeah, exactly. They were listening to our phone calls. But it's just amazing that this goes on. And you say, wait a minute. You have all these stories, and this is supposed to be this super, what would you like, a sophisticated system that they have there. And then what it all bugs down to is a few people who are doing, drugs and cheating on tests, and they are charged with, the most dangerous weapons in the world.
Pretty stimulating.
Yeah.
Jerry,
unreal.
What do you think, sir?
Well, the Air Force has been having problems with its personnel for a long time. Even going back
Jesus
to
Jesus
hasn't
helped you on that.
What's that?
I'm sure you've heard there was a lot of Christian proselytizing at the Air Force Academy, and I said that Jesus hasn't helped them on this problem.
Well, that's what I was alluding to, that there were a bunch of super religious freaks running the Air Force Academy for a while. And this supposedly elite group, many of them are Academy graduates. I mean, the general that was a drunk, and then there were two officers who had the drug problem, as I recall. I read the article the other day. And yes, then it turned out that they were all cheating on the tests. Now, that's a command problem at the top. If command doesn't know what's going on, there's a real problem. And that needs to be investigated. I mean, the Inspector General or the House Military Committee, I mean, they need to inspect this and see what's going on in the Air Force.
Thank you, sir. Alan, your thoughts?
Well, I live about 250 miles away from my North Dakota where all this is going on. And, this isn't the first time that stuff like this has happened. A number of years ago, I can remember, where they loaded a bunch of bombs on I think it was some kind of nuclear missiles. They loaded them on a plane, and they flew it to some Air Force base down south, and they weren't even supposed to have loaded the bombs. And so they were carrying these bombs, and nobody even knew they had them on board. Then several months ago, they were leaving doors open in these missile silos that weren't supposed to be left open. You know, it's just been one series of shenanigans after another. And but this is typical of the kind of people that work in, this whole nuclear industry and the militarized nuclear industries. And, the only thing to do is put an end to all this nuclear warfare and everything. Get rid of all these nuclear missiles, and that's the real solution, because we're always going to have problems. How long is it going to be before we have a major accident with these nuclear weapons? Then lots and lots of people are going to be killed, and Fukushima will look like some kind of Sunday school picnic. But it's an accident waiting to happen when you got these kinds of people in charge. This is the kind of people though that the military attracts. What do you expect?
Yep. Okay. Now we've talked about several very difficult topics, and most of them were pretty unpleasant. Let me take you to another place and ask you about a positive topic, or at least one I regard as very positive. And I say this with my tongue in my cheek, but I think you know where I'm coming from. The surprisingly Christian Pope Francis. let me start with you, Alan. This new pope, I mean, my goodness, after years and years and years of the most horrible, hideous scandals, here we have a man that actually washes the people's feet, a man who has a modest little car, a man who puts away the royal gold-gilded bullshit. What's your thoughts,
well,
Adam,
I think,
on this new pope?
I think it's good that we finally have a pope that's concerned about poverty and the inequalities that capitalism breeds. And I think this is very important. It's going to change a lot of people's outlooks here in this country and around the world. And he's created some real important discussions, and I support that all the way.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. Jerry, any thoughts on Pope Francis?
Yeah, absolutely. Not being a religious person myself, I recognize that many, many people are, and they need leadership. And so far, he's been a leader. He is bringing people back to the humility that religion espouses. That's not a bad thing at all. Not at all. Religion has gotten a little bit too dogmatic. It's gotten a little bit too conservative, too powerful, and this is a welcome change.
Thank you, sir. Lewis, sir.
Yeah, for you know, when you think in terms of church history, and you go back, you know, 2,000 years plus, this is a monolithic, unchangeable, you know, engine out there that is, you know, is self-protecting, and for this individual to rise, and he actually told the other cardinals when he was elected by them, you're going to be sorry you did this. he actually told them that, he warned them. But it reminds me of a little film that was made. It was a book by an Australian novelist, West, I think it was, The Shoes of a Fisherman. And they made it a movie with Anthony Quinn, I think it was, a Russian pope. And you see this quest, you know, for change. And, of course, it's also driven by the fact that there's so very many people within the Catholicism who want to see a change, and he personifies that. The question is, what can you do against the College of Cardinals? Because that's really, it's like the U.S. Senate. You know, you can't change anything. You can't get anything done. You've got all these people responding to different agendas, their own agendas and everybody's agendas. And how long before they gang up on him? You know, it is, I'm being cynical because I know church history. You know, I studied
sure,
it.
Sure.
I've been through that, through those things, and I know how these people work. I wish him good luck, and I think that he's doing the right thing. As you said before, you know, for a change, you got a Christian pope.
Who would have guessed?
And you know, and what he's doing, what he's you know, coming up with is amazing, and he's telling people that, you know, focus on the message, forget about all these hates that you have, forget about, you know, there is another way of dealing with these things. It was incredible that he just he hasn't been spoken about much, but he also cleaned house with a financial system.
Vatican Bank, yeah.
The Vatican, yeah. I mean, something that hasn't been done in centuries, really. Yeah. So let's hope that this keeps on working and he maintains himself in good health.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. Carl, any thoughts on the surprise pope?
Yeah, I think it's really refreshing to have a pope who is willing to invite a homeless guy to his birthday lunch. I mean, and let a little boy with Down syndrome ride in the Pope mobile. And you know, when that little kid like ran up on stage while he was doing Pope ceremonies, like the kid was up on stage goofing around, and the Pope just kind of let him do his thing. I thought that was really cool with the Pope. And, you know, just like the previous speaker mentioned, firing all but one official of the Vatican Bank. You know, after Pope Benedict pretty much guaranteed all of his homies with another 5 years of jobs, and, you know, Pope Francis walked in and changed that. I thought that was really great. Now I think it's up to Pope Francis to continue being that voice of the people, where, you know, we have greater income inequality in this country and certainly around the world than we have in, you know, the last century. So Pope Francis really needs to keep being the New Testament Christian that he's being, and meet with these world leaders and, you know, press them to take serious action against poverty and income inequality. Yeah, and I also say this, you know, whenever I talk to people who, you know, say that they're religious and that they're Christians and, you know, make all of these anti-poor and anti-unemployed people arguments, I like to remind them that Jesus was the same guy who said that the meek shall inherit the earth, that it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get into heaven, that he told the young rich ruler to give up all of his wealth and follow him. You know, Jesus was very much a socialist or a Marxist, as Rush Limbaugh would say. So, I mean, Pope Francis is definitely a Christian pope, and I think that's really refreshing to see.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah,
but
I think that there's a...
Go ahead, Louis.
Yeah, there's something else. You know, it's the first pope who rattles the Republicans. He really came out, and Paul Ryan, this grand inquisitor wannabe, suddenly he's shut down by the Pope. You know, sorry, and you can't be a cardinal either. That's it.
Christians love to say that they're Christian men, and so when you mm-hmm. take that moral high ground away from them, all you have left is just naked greed and fascism, and they don't have a leg to stand on morally after that.
Exactly.
When the Pope says you're wrong, you're just wrong, and that's just how it is.
Well, gentlemen, after that really charming distraction of an amazingly Christian Pope, I want to take up another very serious topic, and I will use no frivolity with this, but we have been having almost a weekly school shooting, and it's a shame and a blight on this country. With so many good people, to have the kind of idiocy in our gun laws. I'm going to ask you this question, like you each to respond in kind. What can sensible people do in the face of this lock on the legislative wallet or mind, whichever you want to prefer? So let me start with you, Carl.
Yeah, the gun issue is a really tricky one because it's very polarizing, you know, and even in my world of activism and my fellow comrades, I mean, it's still a very divisive issue. You know, people absolutely, I feel, have the right to bear arms, you know, and I also think there should be sensible legislation that prevents people with criminal backgrounds or mental histories from obtaining weapons, certainly, but I think there are so many guns out there now, and unless you do like Bloomberg was doing in the last week he was mayor in New York, where he's basically knocking on people's doors and collecting guns, I think it's going to be really hard to legislate gun control in this country. I will say, though, in the gun debate, it's very helpful. If you replace the words gun control with gorilla control like The Onion did, The Onion had a great story after Newtown. It said national gorilla sales skyrocket after latest gorilla attack. And, you know, and they interview, like, a guy in a mall who says, you know, imagine if everybody in that mall had a gorilla when that gorilla went loose, you know? Maybe it'd be different. It's like, no, the gorillas would just, you know, wreak havoc everywhere. You know, replace the word gun with a gorilla. You know, every other nation has strict gorilla control, you know? And we should control gorillas here, you know? Gorillas are just as dangerous as guns. I think you can make that argument.
Thank you, sir. Luis, sir, your thoughts on the issue of guns?
It's incredibly tricky and cumbersome, especially when there are so many vested interests involved with it, and a whole armaments industry that is living off that. And they have convinced people that this is, you know, we go back to the antebellum days when they said, well, it's our way of life to have slaves to do this thing. And then now it's our way of life to have the guns, you know. And so these people are making the same argument, only that they are substituting the word guns, you know, for slaves. And the other one thing is that there's a failure to come up with terminology that says, okay, let's, you know, gun control just immediately sends out a bunch of signals out there to these people, for lack of a better word. But you know, when you say the regulate, you say, let's go back. And even if you, you know, the whole Second Amendment has been prostituted like crazy. In fact, you know, we have a political party that says this is the most important of all the amendments to the Constitution. You know, and so they stand by it. It is just pathetic. And having been an educator, having taught all levels of school, you know, it just breaks my heart. And this is nothing new because, you know, I went back years and years ago when we did have policemen. They called them officer friendly at a school. You know, in particular, in this case, in Gainesville High School.
It's been replaced by Officer SWAT, I'm afraid.
Yeah, now exactly. Now you have an unarmed team ready at the ready out there. But, I mean, these were, you know, police officers with guns, and they spent the whole day at the school. Usually when there was a problem, they were nowhere near to be found. You know, and the teachers, as always, had to take the brunt of it. As you see, the last one, you know, it was a teacher who had to come up, you know, and stop the whole thing. And I myself flew through a window one time trying to put a stop to a fight, you know, between two gangs in one high school. So, you know, having seen these things, they happen, and if you think that this is bad when you have a fist fight in the school and all that, you think in terms of the access. It is the availability of guns to just about anybody. And the thing is that bothers me a lot is that we keep saying that, you know, we got to make sure that people with mental problems don't get a hold of them. But you know what? That's the problem. People with mental problems are the least likely to commit something like these things on other people. You know, they're more likely to hurt themselves than anybody. But we put them as a punching bag, you know, and then we don't say that there's people with all kinds of gripes, all kinds of grudges, all kinds of problems are in society, that always look for the easiest way to handle it, and boom, here's the gun. You know, and that is the biggest problem, I say, the accessibility, the quantity that is out there, and the easiness with which we, you know, pretty much, you know, it's happened in that Florida theater. You know, an individual who pulls out a gun on this other one at the theater before a movie starts because he's texting. You know, what kind of a society are we building? It gets pathetic, and it's endless, and the media kind of contributes to it because it just, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, let's go there. You know, let's break everything up. Let's go there. Let's, you know, and then all these individuals who also want attention, you see their faces coming on TV over and over and over again, you know, minute after minute. And isn't that exactly what they wanted, some of them? So mm-hmm. It's a very complex matter.
Thank you. Jerry, your thoughts on gun control, especially in the light of these continued school shootings and movie theater shootings?
Well, it certainly concerns me because I'm in public schools every day, all over Orange County and several other counties. I am amazed that we still keep putting politicians in office that won't do anything about it. Now, maybe the latest school shootings, maybe Sandy, Sandy Hook, or what, you know, the Connecticut, maybe that'll energize people. I don't know. But it's not going to end unless we take action to end it. And the only way to do that is to elect people who will end it. Now, how do we do that?
I guess get the money out of the politics is probably about the first step we have to take. Let me ask you, Alan. You are up in the north central part of the United States, clearly an area where there's a lot of hunters. How does a gun control play up your way?
Well, I would probably say close to 95% of the people are against gun control. I'm against gun control myself. I think we're dealing with a very violent society that we have to change. That's what we got to do to handle this problem. And no attempt is being made to make our society more civil. Everything that we see on the, in the movies and everything, it's all based on violence. Little kids are playing these video games, shoot up, shoot this person, shoot that person. People are playing video games where they pretend they're assassinating Fidel Castro. You know, this is a very sick society, and it doesn't make any difference what kind of gun control you have. You're going to have this violence in one way or another. People can be killed many other ways besides with guns. I lived in Canada, in Manitoba, for 10 years, and everybody around me had a gun. I can't ever remember a single armed robbery or anybody being shot with a gun in the area around where I lived. And here in the United States, you know, it's nothing to see. I walked into a gas station down on the Iron Range a couple weeks ago, and I'm standing in back of a guy, and he's got a great big pistol stuck in his belt. And I thought, oh, geez, this guy's going to rob the place. And so I started joking with him. I said, geez, that's quite a gun you got there. And he says, yeah, I carry it wherever I go. And, you know, this is the kind of society that's been created, where we got people walking all over the place with guns now. It's crazy. It's insane. It's our society. It's not the guns themselves, but society. And they allow these people to manufacture all these automatic weapons. I mean, what role is there in any society for people to have all these automatic weapons and everything? And there's no reason at all, just somebody's making a lot of money off of these guns. So I think those kinds of guns, the militarized guns, should be taken out of from being sold to anybody on the street.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I just want to say, here in northern Minnesota, we got these gangs running around on the Indian reservations and everything, and they're very violent, and they've used guns to intimidate and badger people, but they're being used by the corrupt politicians in power on those reservations, so they maintain that power. The FBI could easily deal with this problem if they wanted to, but they don't. So, you know, what good does gun control do if the police are allowing these people to run free and intimidate and shoot people up and everything?
Yeah. Thank you, sir. Let me ask you all another question. I'm going to go ahead and start back with Alan. I don't know if you've heard, but recently there's been another ruling in Monsanto's favor. Let me just outline this quickly for you. The U.S. Supreme Court Wednesday refused to hear an appeal seeking to prevent Monsanto from suing farmers who inadvertently grew crops contaminated by its genetically engineered seed. It was the second time top U.S. court sides with the American agro-giant and its running fight with farmers over seed patent rights after a ruling in its favor in May 2013 involving an Indiana farmer. In the latest case, Organic Seed Growers and Trade Association had asked that Monsanto agree not to sue farmers if they inadvertently grew plants containing traits of patented genetic engineered seed. In rejecting the suit without comment, the Supreme Court let stand a federal appeals court ruling that the group's challenge was unwarranted because Monsanto had already given binding assurances it would not sue when only trace amounts of a genetically modified seed were involved. Monsanto had argued that then to grant the organic request would allow farmers to intentionally violate its patents. The company has filed more than 100 lawsuits in the United States against farmers it alleged planted seeds without paying royalties. Alan, you're up in the Midwest, grain country. Is this something that you hear up there?
Yeah, it's a big problem around here and in North Dakota, also in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. And what it is an attempt to, by Monsanto to just totally control agriculture is what it amounts to. And, you know, it's a bad decision, just like most of the other Supreme Court decisions. It's just like Citizens United. It gives the corporations the power over the people and over our food. And it's a decision that shouldn't be allowed to stand, in my opinion.
Thank you, sir. Jerry, any thoughts on this Monsanto ruling?
Yeah, I've been fighting against the GMO products for a long time. And interestingly enough, I mean, the TPP is fighting it as well, because what's going to happen is that, first of all, my opinion is that nobody should have a patent over life. And if a seed isn't life, I don't know what is. The patent itself, to me, is outrageous. And so what they're doing is selling life instead of helping farmers make a living. It's just patently wrong. And Monsanto will keep on with this. I mean, last year, the government tried to hold Monsanto harmless against any lawsuits because of Roundup and things like that. It's a blatant abuse of corporate privilege. And someday we're going to have to get back to, hey, we tell the corporations what to do. They don't tell us what to do.
Thank you, sir. Luis?
Yeah, you know, when you think of Monsanto and the incredible amount of power that they have and what they've done, this is a company that actually tried to force you know, its way into the production of maize, and it tried to patent what the you know, the Aztecs, the Mayans, Aztecs, and other civilizations of the Americas have been doing and working with for thousands of years naturally, and
they call that the time
machine
technique.
You know, they had the gall to try to say we have a patent to that. You know, we are controlling that. On the other hand, this is a company that is engineering all these things, and then is releasing them out there, because I mean it's been found all these genetically modified seeds have been found out in the wild, and what ecological damage we will have in time is just not known. It's the last time that we had an ecological impact of that kind was, you know, during the so-called age of exploration, where all these people were crossing continent to continent, and they were taking all these things from one place to the other, and at least they didn't have the knowledge of genetics or anything like that at that time, but they were carrying with them not only disease, but they were carrying plants and animals that damaged the and affected the ecosystems of all the continents, you know, in the 15, 1600s. And so we're having a situation here. For example, it was in Seattle and then in Oregon also that they found that there was these sections in a wheat field, I think right. It was in Oregon, and they found that there was this wild form that they hadn't seen. And then the other one, part of it is that sometimes they have either pesticides or they have allergens and things like that that people don't know about and they're going to be impacted with. And the thing is, Monsanto is fighting not only to have this control over life, like Jerry said, with controlling the seeds and therefore controlling agriculture and the food of the world, but they're also going out and, you know, impacting the lives of people directly and indirectly.
Thank you, sir. And then, Carl, your thoughts on Monsanto?
Yeah, I think we have to realize, you know, any sane, rational human being knows that you can't put a patent on life.
You know, so the fact that this court ruling went the way it did, I mean, I think it's part of a greater strategy. And I think we need to acknowledge that, you know, our government serves corporate interests and profit before it serves people, you know, and that includes the court, mm-hmm. sadly. Now, you know, there's a great Venn diagram out there I would encourage your listeners to check out. And it's a Venn diagram of Monsanto officials who also became U.S. government officials. And yeah. so, you know, like Michael Taylor, he was he's Obama's food safety czar. He's also VP of Monsanto's government affairs. You know, he's Monsanto's chief lobbyist. And so now he's, you know, talking about food safety. I mean, that's such a blatant abuse of power. Now, Monsanto, I think, is also exercising their global power as part of a larger global strategy. And now I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where, right. you know, essentially it's an alleged trade agreement, even though, you know, only a few paragraphs of the whole thing mention trade at all. But what it essentially does is lets corporations skirt whatever rules and regulations they want to avoid and actually sue governments if they feel that a law will infringe upon their profits. So, you know, let's say, like, Argentina, I think, banned GMO maize from being grown there. You know, so theoretically, under the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Monsanto can sue any government that does something like that because it infringes on their profits. And so we need to realize there's a power move being played by Monsanto and these other companies that are actively trying to supersede government authority so we can have a one-world corporate government. Now, you know, and that sounds radical, but, I mean, that's essentially what's happening right now. Another example. Now, Monsanto, back when they were known as Monsanto Company in the 70s, one of their subsidiaries was a company called Pharmacia. Pharmacia eventually became independent and is now known as Pfizer. Now, if you go to Mystic, Connecticut, I used to live in Connecticut for a little while, and in Mystic, Connecticut, right on the Rhode Island border, there's a Monsanto corn-growing facility. There's only a few greenhouses back there, so it's not mass-producing corn. It's just mastering the GMO crops that they're growing. Also, in Groton, Connecticut, the adjacent town next to Mystic, there's a huge Pfizer manufacturing plant. I think it's their largest manufacturing plant in the world. So Monsanto and Pfizer and the GM companies and the pharmaceutical companies have a vested interest in feeding us food that makes us sick and then making us dependent on their prescription drugs so they can make money off of us from birth to death. We need people in the media to acknowledge this, that this is happening, and, you know, we can start to mobilize a larger global response. I think addressing the serious problem of Monsanto requires global solidarity with activist movements all over the world, from India to the U.S., and, you know, so I think we need to take some serious drastic measures here, but also realize that this is part of a global strategy.
Well, gentlemen, thank you all so much for joining me. I so appreciate the wisdom and the thought and the experience you bring to this table. And I thank you, each and every one of you, for joining me. You've provided some really thought-provoking material with each of your comments. So I hope you'll join me again soon. And let me thank you each. Carl, thank you. Luis, thank you, sir. Jerry, thank you. And Alan, thank you for joining me. And, gentlemen, I hope to see you all soon.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Okay,
good night all.
Okay, take care, guys. I need to do a couple of things on the outside. I want to thank you, and I want to thank you, my good friends, other fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden-Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Miss Anita Stewart and her show Wise Women Media, Susan Nylon, The Nylon Report, Sita Baguil and the Sita Media Show, and Harriet Lerman, her show Voice of the People, and also another international broadcaster I want to urge you to pay attention to is Harry Shearer and the Harry Shearer Show. These are all wonderful progressive broadcasters. I hope you enjoy them. Tune in next week when we provide our environmental show, first environmental show of the year. Hope you tune in. We've got some great guests. We've got the Bee Lady. We've got our friends from the Water Cleanup Project, and our many other good friends from the environmental front. So hope to hear from you and hope to see you next week when Progressive News Networks brings you The Green Show. Thanks again. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye. I'm your host, Rick Spisak. Wish you a wonderful week ahead. Whoa.
gone.